We now continue with the second tape of this two-tape series, Which Bishop Should I Follow? The original recording was not recorded very plain, and now I am re-recording it, trying to increase the volume. I realize it has some background music, but I hope you can understand what is being said and bear with it. Thank you.
He said to them, during these last days on earth, as the Father hath sent me, I also send you. So the Father has sent the Son, and the Son sends the pastors of the church. Nor will this mission ever be interrupted so long as the world lasts. Peter will ever institute the bishops. The bishops will ever delegate a portion of their own authority to the priests who have the charge of souls. No human power shall ever be able to intercept this transmission, or have power to set up as pastors them that have not partaken of it. And that's the end of the reading of Tom Geringer for now. But here then I turn to the encyclical letter of Pope Pius XI, Mortalium Animos, 6th of January, 1928. And a part of it he says, quote, not only must the church still exist today and continue always to exist, but it must ever be exactly the same as it was in the days of the apostles, unquote. And here Don Geringer has explained to us how it was in the days of the apostles. This is the essence, you might say, the nature of the church that Jesus Christ founded, how all the authority comes from himself to St. Peter or to his lawful successors and then given to the other bishops and members of the hierarchy. But to try and explain this point from another point of view, I turn now to the encyclical letter of Pope Pius XII, Mediator Dei, 1947, in Christian Worship. I'm reading from the one put out by the Catholic Truth Society. And I open to page 25 under paragraph 49, and then I'm going down to paragraph 50. The sacred liturgy has a very close connection with the chief doctrines of that the Church teaches is most certainly true. It must therefore remain in perfect conformity with the pronouncement of the Catholic faith issued by the Church's supreme teaching authority to safeguard the integrity of revealed truth. The worship the Church pays to God is, as St. Augustine seriously puts it, a continual profession of Catholic faith and an exercise of hope and charity. God, he says, is to be worshipped by faith, hope, and charity. In the liturgy, we make explicit profession of the Catholic faith, not only by celebrating the various mysteries, not only by offering the sacrifice and administering the sacraments, but also by reciting or singing the Creed, the Christian watchword, by reading other documents, and also the divinely inspired scriptures. Thus, the whole liturgy contains the Catholic faith, inasmuch as it is a public profession of the faith of the Church. This is why, whenever some divinely revealed truth has to be defined, popes and councils have frequently used the liturgy as a theological source of arguments. Our predecessor, Pope Pius IX, for example, did this when he defined the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin. Similarly, whenever some doubtful question was under discussion, the Church and the Fathers have been accustomed to seek light in the venerable and traditional sacred rites. Thus is the origin of the well-known and time-honored principle, quote, that the law of prayer established the law of belief. And with this knowledge, then, that the liturgy contains the whole worship of the Church, let me turn to another book of the liturgical year by Abbot Geringer, OSB. This is book 3, or volume 3, book 2, on Christmas, up into the part where he writes about Feast of St. Agnes on page 358. Nor must be passed over in silence the gracious tribute of honor paid by Rome each year on this feast to her beloved martyr. Two lambs are placed on the altar of the Basilica Nomentana. They are emblems of the meekness of Jesus and the innocence of the gentle Agnes. After they have been blessed by the abbot of the religious community which serves this church, they are taken to a monastery of nuns where they are carefully reared. Their wallet is used for making the palliums, which the Pope sends to all patriarchs and metropolitans of the Catholic world as the essential emblem of their jurisdiction. So here we have in the very liturgy of the Church, which we just heard what Pope Pius XII said about the liturgy, teaching us that all jurisdiction comes from the Pope. And now I'm referring to the Summa Theologica of St. Thomas Aquinas, translated by the Fathers in the English Dominican Providence, and published by Benedictine Brothers Incorporated, as a Nicol Obstate, by the Reverend Monsignor John M. Ferens, and an Emperor Martyr by Francis Cardinal Spellman, New York, 1948. And I opened to page 2644 in volume 3, question 22, article 1, in the reply to objection 1. Excommunication is an act of the keys, not directly, but with respect to the external judgment. The sentence of excommunication, however, though it is promulgated by an external verdict, still, as it belongs somewhat to the entrance to the kingdom, insofar as the church militant is the way to the church triumphant, this jurisdiction whereby man is competent to excommunicate can be called a key. It is in this sense that some distinguish between the key of orders, which all priests have, and the key of jurisdiction in the tribunal of judgment, which none have but the judges of the external tribunal. Nevertheless, God bestowed both on Peter in Matthew chapter 16, verse 19, from whom they are derived by others, whichever of them they have. And there are a number of other places that give reference to this teaching that all authority comes from the Pope to the bishops and so on. But now I turn to volume 8 of the Catholic Encyclopedias, as a Nicol Obstate, June 1st, 1910, by Remy Lafort, and an imprimatur by John M. Farley, copyright 1910 by Robert Appleton Company. As I said, if you want to look under keys on page 632, you'll find this teaching that all the authority comes from the Pope. But I think sufficient has been given. I'm not going to read that, but to express more some of the other 9 points I outlined about jurisdiction, I'm going to turn to page 751, where it is teaching about the laity and as to their jurisdiction and administration in the church. The principle is that the laity as such have no share in the spiritual jurisdiction and government of the church, but they may be commissioned or delegated by ecclesiastical authority to exercise certain rights, especially when there is no question of strictly spiritual jurisdiction, for instance, in the administration of property. The laity are incapable, if not by divine law, at least by canon law, of real jurisdiction in the church. The laity have no authority over things or persons ecclesiastical. It is their duty to obey, not to command. Therefore, no official acts requiring real ecclesiastical jurisdiction can be properly performed by the laity. If performed by them, they are null and void. And the article goes on to explain how it was not really the laity who elected popes in the earlier ages of the church. The laity, namely, just, so to speak, nominated or expressed who they wished to have become the Pope, but the final election was always left to the bishops, the hierarchy, the clerics who had jurisdiction in and of the Catholic Church. And now I turn to another book, A Manual of Pastoral Theology by the Reverend Frederick Schultz, D.D. Has it Nicol Obstate by Johannes Rothensteiner, and the imprimatur by Johannes J. Glennon, copyright 1923 by the B. Herder Book Company. I read from page 295 under the chapter 7 of Holy Orders. Speaking of the powers of the priesthood, we have to distinguish between the power of orders and the power of jurisdiction. As man consists of body and soul, the body being the external agent, the soul the internal life-giving principle, so the Church of Christ is both a visible society in an external form and an invisible spiritual being. As a visible society, she is vested with jurisdiction over her members. As an invisible being, she exercises a life-giving ministry. Jurisdiction rests with the hierarchy, the Pope as the head of the Church, and the bishops in their respective dioceses. This jurisdiction the bishop does not obtain through episcopal consecration. It is conveyed to him by the authority of the Holy See and the apostolic brief appointing him and setting him up as a ruler over the portion of Christ's vineyard. Quote, no temporal sovereign or state can give this jurisdiction. It is not earthly, but of heavenly creation. It is empathetically a power from God. The channel of its derivation is through the apostolate. Once clothed with it and invested with it, his mission, the bishop is the ruler of the churches, the custodian of God's law, the enforcer of ecclesiastical canons, the father of his clergy, the pastor of his people, the chief preacher of the word of God to the flock, and the guide of souls. All other ministries are exercised in dependence of him, unquote. From Eula Thorne, Ecclesiastical Discourses, page 103. Going on. A priest by his ordination has no jurisdiction, but he is called upon to cooperate with the bishop. The latter is supposed to communicate to him a part of that power which he has obtained by apostolic appointment. We say part of that power because jurisdiction is twofold, in the internal form and in the external form. In the internal form, which is exercised mainly in the tribunal of penance, a priest receives when he is authorized to hear confessions. In the external form, he participates to a certain extent after the bishop has assigned him to a regular position as pastor or rector ecclesiae. This jurisdiction is not perpetual, but may be limited or withdrawn for good reasons. Not so at the power of orders. It is received through the sacrament of holy orders, and, being attached to the indelible character which this sacrament imprints, cannot be destroyed or taken away. Only the use of it may be suspended. Any ministerial act exercised in spite of a suspension will become sinful, without, however, losing its effect or forfeiting its validity, except the absolution given by Vitandas. And then someone wrote here, you can see Canon 2261, I believe, to clarify that last statement. Now to explain some of the other 9 points I said about jurisdiction, I turn to another book, Sacramental Theology, a textbook for advanced students by Clarence McAuliffe, S.J. Imperii Potest by Leo J. Burns, S.J. Imprimatur by Joseph E. Ritter, S.T.D., Archbishop of St. Louis, April 25, 1958. Copyright 1958 by B. Herder Book Company. I'm turning now to pages 300, then to 301 and 302. Where he speaks about the sacrament of penance. We treat only of the minister who can validly confer the sacrament. Other conditions are prescribed for licit administration. Explanation of terms. No one except a priest. A priest is the one who has the priestly character bestowed by the sacrament of orders. Hence, both bishops and priests are valid ministers. Deacons, subdeacons, all others are excluded. Number two. A priest needs special faculties. This means that even an ordained priest must also receive jurisdiction or ruling power in order to absolve validly. Priestly ordination is not enough. The character of the priesthood confers the sanctifying power necessary for the remission of sins, but not the ruling power, which every judge must have. A bishop or priest can receive this power in either of two ways. He may be appointed to a certain office like the bishopric or a diocese or the pastorate of a parish. Such appointments automatically confer faculties to hear confessions. The same faculties can also be obtained by delegation from a superior as when a bishop grants them to religious priests. I'm interrupting the text here a moment to point out that these appointments to a parish, to a diocese, to be a religious superior, and so on, That appointment itself must always come from someone who himself has jurisdiction in and of the Catholic Church. Continuing on here with the book. But unless a priest has ruling power, he cannot validly absolve. Mere ordination of the priesthood never confers this power. The conclusion then has two parts. First, no one except a priest can administer the sacrament of penance. Second, to do so, even a priest needs faculties. Dogmatic note. The first part is of divine faith in the Council of Trent. You can see Dingiger's Sources of Catholic Dogma, number 920, or see the Council of Trent, number 809. Reads, quote, if anyone says that priests alone are not the ministers of absolution, let him be anathema, unquote. The second part is also divine faith in the same council. You can see Dingiger's 903 or the Council of Trent 796. When it states that it ratifies, it's most true what the Church has always held, namely, quote, that the absolution which a priest confers on one over whom he has neither ordinary or delegated jurisdiction ought to be reckoned of no worth, unquote. From this statement it follows as Catholic doctrine that a priest does not receive faculties but ordination alone. The council supposes that the minister is a, quote, priest, unquote, that is, validly ordained. Yet it says that his absolution is of no worth unless he has either ordinary or delegated jurisdiction. Consequently, he did not receive this jurisdiction by the mere fact of his ordination. And skipping over part one, where he proves that from the different fathers of the Church, I come down to part two. Even a priest needs special faculties. Proof two, from theological reasoning, the argument follows in form. Juridical power involves the exercise of jurisdiction, but the power to absolve or retain sins is juridical power. Therefore, the power to absolve or retain sins involves the exercise of jurisdiction. Proof the major, a judge binds or looses the wills of men by imposing or liberating from obligations. This involves the exercise of jurisdiction which he cannot assume on his own authority. He must have public power. Proof of the minor, it is clear from the second conclusion. And then comes down to proof three. From the practice of the Church as revealed by the prescriptions of canon law. The Court of Canon Law, paragraph 872, states, quote, besides the power of orders, the minister to absolve validly must have either ordinary or delegated power of jurisdiction over the penitent, unquote. From this declaration, it is evident that delegated jurisdiction to absolve is not conferred by priestly ordination or episcopal consecration. That ordinary jurisdiction is not granted follows from the fact that no one receives a parish or diocese by his ordination. And so from this teaching of the Church, it should be made very clear that I'm asking you to please take special note of this last part from the Court of Canon Law. Besides the power of orders, the minister to absolve sins validly must have either ordinary or delegated power of jurisdiction over the penitent. Remember those two important words when we speak of jurisdiction, ordinary or delegated, because except in certain cases of danger of death, as it just said here, unless one and some priest or bishop has that ordinary or delegated jurisdiction, he does not absolve your sins validly. This will be covered more shortly. But now let me turn to the Summa St. Thomas Aquinas again on page 2645, question 22, article 3 of the supplement, where he gives, I answer that, jurisdiction can only be used in relation to another man. Consequently, since every excommunicated person is suffered from the communion of the faithful, he is deprived of the use of jurisdiction. And here then the Prince of Theologians, St. Thomas Aquinas, has told us that as soon as someone is excommunicated, and we know that every heretic, apostate, and schismatic are automatically excommunicated, even if they had either ordinary or delegated jurisdiction before that time, when they are truly excommunicated, then they lose the use of their jurisdiction. I'm asking you to keep that point very well in mind, as I will try to explain clearly a little bit later on, after we've covered more jurisdiction, that all those who were consecrated others without a papal mandate are excommunicated in a manner most specially reserved to the Holy See, which would include, of course, Bishop Francis Schuckardt and all the old Catholic line he came through. It would also include Archbishop Tuck and every bishop that came from him directly or through another bishop that Tuck himself consecrated. But now I'm going to turn to another very important book titled Supplied Jurisdiction According to Canon 209, an Historical Synopsis and Commentary. It's under the Catholic University of America, Canon Law Studies, number 102. It is written by a priest, the Reverend Francis, now I will spell his middle and last name, capital S-I-G-I-S-M-U-N-D, and capital M-I-A-S-K-I-E-W-I-C-C. This is a 340-page book, and if you look in the back, this author has well over 250 reference sources in his bibliography, plus I think well over 100 more sources, reference sources and articles and periodicals. And so this priest who wrote this book, Supplied Jurisdiction According to Canon 209, has himself done this tremendous amount of research of going through all the writings and teachings of this history of the church, you might say, to supply to us then the teaching of the church on this important subject, because this is the canon that so many people are invoking in the world today to obtain what they call supplied jurisdiction or emergency jurisdiction. And in many cases, in reading this book, you will see that that jurisdiction really does not apply that they think it will apply. Briefly then, to give you a definition of Canon 209, it reads, quote, in common error or in positive and probable doubt of law or of fact, the church supplies jurisdiction both for the external and for the internal forum. And now I'm going to just relate to you some of these teachings of the Catholic Church with regards to the supplied jurisdiction according to Canon 209. On page 19, it reads, the censored heretics and schismatics are not fit subjects of jurisdiction, inasmuch as their transgression has placed them outside the pale of active membership in the Church. Such persons are always forbidden to exercise jurisdictional power under the sanction that such an exercise will be an unlawful act. However, not always are their acts invalid, as Canon 2265, Section 1, Number 2, and Canon 2275 and Canon 2283 explicitly state. It is only when such a person is a vitandus, or when a declaratory or condemnatory sentence has been executed against him, that his jurisdiction acts will be invalid. On page 22 reads, to protect the faithful against deception and to assure them of competent and worthy ministers, the Church has always insisted and still does insist that those who are to minister unto the faithful in the name of Christ and of the Church must first receive the approval and authorization necessary for the valid and licit performance of jurisdictional acts. And on page 22 it reads, the matter of jurisdiction then is very important. First, the necessity for it supplies the Church with strict sanctions against usurpers and incompetents. The possession of it is important also for the priest who, in acting without it, would not only oppose it invalid acts, but would run afoul of the rigid sanctions of the Church and of God. Finally, it is especially clear how important the use of it is to the faithful, and what a great loss it would be for them to approach a priest adjudged to have faculties to absolve, confessed, and then upon their confession depart not knowing that they were still unabsolved. To interrupt the text here then, it is showing that indeed one may go to confession to a priest whom he thinks is going to absolve him, who has the jurisdiction and so on, but still leave the confession with his sins unabsolved. Continue with the book. This entire thesis will treat of such instances as the last one, that is, of instances in which, upon the presence or absence of jurisdiction, the very validity or the invalidity of the acts will depend. The general rule regarding the possession of jurisdiction for validity was well summarized by Wirtz, Vital. Those are two theologians that work together. There is no jurisdiction without a title. I interrupt to ask you to take note of that. There is no jurisdiction without a title. In a moment I will explain what that means. Going on. And where by mandate of the church or her rightful representatives, jurisdiction is required for the validity of a certain act, there if the minister acts without the proper jurisdiction, he acts fruitlessly because invalidly. I interrupt then again a moment to mention that, for example, when Bishop Schuckardt tried to receive religious vows, himself having no jurisdiction, he acted invalidly, and those vows are invalid. Going on to the text. In such individual instances, it is useless to bring up an argument for validity, the presence of good faith on the part of the priest or the individual. So to interrupt again to explain that, even if you have good faith, that in itself does not make valid that which is invalid unless these requirements of the church are fulfilled. And now to go back to explain what this meant when it said there is no jurisdiction without a title, I flip back again to page 15. As D'Annibale observed, a title may be one of three kinds, true, colored, and putative. A title is first of all true when validly received from a fully competent superior. Thus a pastor has a true title to his parish if the proper bishop legitimately installs him in parochial office. I'm interrupting just to ask you to note that and keep it in mind in all the things you hear on this tape. Continuing on. A title which is not true is either colored or putative. A colored title is one which has the appearance of a true title inasmuch as it is conferred by competent superior. However, even though no defect appears in the concession of the title, it labors under an occult defect which deviates it and renders it invalid. The defect may be in the part of one granting or of the one receiving it, or even in the manner of its conferring. The defect may be on the part of the one conferring it, as for example, if the one granting it should have been deprived of jurisdiction for some of the many causes like disposition, revocation, etc. And I'm going to add for being excommunicated, which is still unknown to the public at large. The defect may be on the part of the one receiving it, as for example, if the one receiving it were rendered by the law incapable of such reception because of an occult censor. And finally, the defect may arise from the manner of its conferring, as for example, if in the process there were substantial error or simony involved. A putative title is present whenever a person pretends to be endowed with power. Whether he does so in good faith or in bad does not make any difference. And so again, let us take careful note of these teachings of the Catholic Church. And there are a great many other things I wish to share with you from this book, Supplied Jurisdiction under Canon 209. But because it is quite involved and somewhat difficult to understand and rather lengthy explanation, I think I will just maybe have to put that on another tape or explain it to some people in person, something to that manner. But before we completely drop this section on supply jurisdiction to Canon 209, I wish to turn to another book titled The Jurisdiction of the Confessor by Reverend James P. Kelly. Has it Nicol Obstate by Arthur J. Shanlon, and the Emperor Martyr by Patrick Cardinal Hayes, Archbishop of New York, September 27th, 1928, published by Benzigan Brothers. And I open then to pages 136 and 137, where this priest, and Father Kelly himself is a quite liberal priest compared to what I've read in these other books. But anyway, he speaks of the licit use of this jurisdiction under Canon 209. It reads, "Hitherto the validity of the absolution was the only question under discussion, and nothing was said of the laicity of the action of the priest in absolving when the faithful generally were in ignorance of his lack of jurisdiction. The question now arises as to the lawfulness of the action of a priest who is wanting in jurisdiction, but who avails himself of the common ignorance of the faithful and the concession of the church to grant absolution from sin. Since Canon 872 requires that the priest possess ordinary or delegated jurisdiction over the penitent in order that he may validly absolve him, it is entirely unlawful for a priest without this jurisdiction to avail himself of the common error of the faithful and force the church to supply jurisdiction unless, one, there is a grave reason for so acting, and two, this cannot be provided for in any other way, at least without grave inconvenience." And I'm interrupting to ask you to note this: number one, there is a grave reason, which would not include devotional confessions, which normally is what people would be making, I believe, day after day in a community such as the Congregation of Mary Immaculate Queen at Spokane, in the City of Mary. I mention this because I flip over now to page 140, where this Father Kelly explains it. The case required in order to absolve licitly, the grave cause necessary to absolve licitly without jurisdiction in virtue of the common error or common ignorance of the faithful, may be taken from among the causes enumerated by St. Alphonsus Maria Liguori as sufficient for the licit use of probable jurisdiction under the old law. These causes are, one, if the precept of confessing urges, even if only because of the penitent is in the state of mortal sin and cannot be liberated in any other way than by confession, and an approved confessor can be obtained only with notable inconvenience. And this Father Kelly gives three other things noted by St. Alphonse Maria Liguori, but this is what is important. One must be in the state of mortal sin, something very serious, before the priest who hears that confession could himself not be guilty of a sin in hearing it. And again, there's much more to cover in that area, but I'm going to now try and explain the ninth point I brought out with regards to jurisdiction. One cannot invoke epikaia to obtain jurisdiction in the external forum. And to do that, I'm going to refer to a book titled The History, Nature, and Use of Epikaia in Moral Theology by the Reverend Lawrence Joseph Riley, ABSTL, as a Nicol Obstate by Francis J. Carnell, CSSR, and an imprimatur by Richard Jacob Cushing, Archbishop of Boston, 7th of May 1948, copyright 1948 by the Catholic University of America Press, Incorporated. And this Father Riley makes a little bit of reference to this on page 5 and 6, but I turn now to page 232 and read, "Intimately connected with this problem is the question of whether or not epikaia has any standing in the external forum. It would appear to be the rather general consensus of authorities today that it has not. Writing in Apollinaris, De Angelo points out that St. Thomas considers epikaia to be a merely moral element, and that modern writers believe it to have reference only to moral and not to juridic matters. While Van Hoove contends that, since epikaia is not an act of jurisdiction, it has value only in the internal forum. Sagmuller states clearly that epikaia is not recognized by law as such. Hollinger likewise maintains that ecclesiastical law does not recognize epikeia, which, being merely subjective attitude on the part of the subject of the law, is valid only for the internal and not for the external forum. Haring believes that modern teaching on law leaves no place for epikeia. Its function is, to a great extent, taken over by, quote, logical interpretation, unquote. A corrective or grammatical interpretation, which results when the investigation of the basis of the law shows that the lawgiver wishes to say more or less than he actually did. Hilling seems almost unwilling to give any standing to epikeia at all, believing that it particularly amounts to self-dispensation, which is in contradiction to law as a binding norm. He concludes at the most that it may be recognized in the internal forum, where one's conscience is the highest subjective obligating force. Of course, if epikeia be understood as an interpretation made according to canonical equity, then it occupies a prominent place in law, concludes Hilling, but its use and treatment in that hypothesis belong to ecclesiastical authority alone, not to any subject of the law. Von Scheer not only dismisses epikeia as being without value in the external form, but he also seems to be of the opinion that it has no standing even in the internal form for its basis. A supposed dispensation is unsubstantial, unimportant, and foreign to law. No aspect of epikeia is more characteristic than its subjectivity. The subject of the law, finding himself involved in the most difficult situation, confronted by a written law which seems to demand immediate observance, realizing that recourse to a superior is impossible, yet believing that the legislator benignly excluded from the law the case at hand, invokes epikeia on his own authority in order to deviate from the clear words of the law. Thus, to insist upon the importance of the subjective element in epikeia, however, is not to deny that there is, and indeed must be, an objective justification for it. Sufficient has already been said of the presumed intention of the legislator, but the point here is that, in spite of the existence and necessity of this objective element, the effects of epikeia are confined to the internal forum. The lack of imputability and lack of guilt for transgressing the letter of the law having standing only in that forum, the internal forum. And that's all I'm going to read from now from that book also. But to help us understand better about the internal and external forum, I turn to the Marino Catholic Dictionary and read for the external forum the definition. The Church acts in the external forum when she exercises her juridical authority over temporal and spiritual affairs of groups or individuals as members of society. In this tribunal, the accused is absolved or condemned exclusively on the basis of the evidence. And the definition for the internal forum, that which is concerned directly with the sanctification of souls and deals with matters of conscience of the individual. In the internal forum, the judge relies on the penitent to accuse or excuse himself unless the contrary is evident. Generally, the Church acts in the internal forum in the sacrament of penance. This is the sacramental forum. There is also the extra sacramental forum or form of conscience which is outside the sacrament of penance. The form of conscience is that in which everything dealt with outside the sacrament of penance and related to the spiritual welfare of the individual is exercised. And because this point is so very important, let me again explain about the external forum. It relates to the Church's authority and jurisdiction for the purpose of looking after the common good and her own interests. And it is in this external forum that the Church has the power to make laws, to grant the right to preach, to excommunicate, to absolve from public censures, and so on. And so, my dear friend, we see that it is this external forum that is involved when the bishops consecrate another bishop without having a papal mandate from Rome. And it is proven then that epikeia cannot be invoked to get around this papal mandate. And now I'm going to try and go into explaining the importance of the papal mandate and why epikaia cannot be invoked to get around this law of the church about the necessity of a papal mandate to consecrate another bishop, and why you cannot invoke canon 20, or to my knowledge, any other canon or combination of canons of the code to get around the church's law about the necessity of the papal mandate. And so I'm asking you to recall to mind what was heard on the first part of this tape, where we listened to the voice of Bishop George Musey explaining to us that no matter what criteria the church had before, since 1917, we do have something to follow, the code of canon law. And in that code was this canon 188, section 4. But also in this same code of canon law, which we must follow, is canon 953, which reads, quote, "Episcopal consecration is reserved to the Roman pontiff in such a way that no bishop is permitted to consecrate anyone as a bishop without first being certain of the pontifical mandate," unquote. And canon 2370 reads, quote, "A bishop who consecrates anyone as a bishop, the bishops or, in the absence of bishops, priests who assist, and the one who receives such consecration without apostolic mandate, contrary to the provision of canon 953, are automatically suspended till the Holy See has dispensed them," unquote. And so from the court of canon law, it should be very clear that at that time, these bishops and so on were only suspended. But on April 9th, 1951, the Supreme Sacred Congregation of the Holy Office in Rome, at the direction of Pope Pius XII, issued this decree, quote, "A bishop of whatsoever right or decree who consecrates to the episcopacy one who has neither been appointed by the Holy See nor expressly confirmed by it, and the person who receives such consecration, even though coerced by grave fear, incur automatic excommunication reserved to the Holy See in a most special manner. This decree exercises its force from the very day of promulgation," unquote, the main part of this decree of April 9th, 1951. But I'm asking you now to take very special notice that the reason this decree was issued was because the essential characteristic mark of the true church, unity, its oneness, was being destroyed. Remember that the unity of the church, the unity of the church, I'm stressing this unity of the church because here Pope Pius XII is telling us that he issued this decree, and later I'm going to read the encyclical where he repeated the same excommunication, because the unity of the church was destroyed. And it is exactly because the unity of the church is being destroyed or denied when one bishop consecrates another without a papal mandate that epikaia cannot be invoked. There are any reasons why epikaia cannot be invoked for this, but that's one very important reason. And it's also a very essential reason why canon 20, or I don't believe any other canon of the code, can be invoked to disregard this necessity of a papal mandate before one bishop consecrates another. And all this now I will try to explain. So let me go on reading part of this decree of April 9th, 1951 to express how Pope Pius XII brought out the unity of the church. "The severity of the decree was extreme and in some respects unique. Hitherto the law would not have taken effect until 3 months had passed, and the consecrator and the new bishop would first have been suspended from exercising their episcopal functions, but not at once excommunicated. The obvious object of the decree was to prevent the setting up of schismatic, though allegedly Catholic, churches in countries dominated by communist regimes. In a number of countries, the communists, having failed to stamp out the Catholic religion by force and persecution, adopted the policy of trying to destroy the church from within by setting up, with the collaboration of disloyal, ambitious, weak, or confused clergy and laity, quote, national, unquote, or, quote, patriarchic, unquote, churches. keeping up most of the appearances of the still existing Catholic Church, but deliberately separated from the absolute essential loyalty to and unity with the Holy See. Okay, it goes on to read. But early in 1958, news came from China that at last, for the first time, the communists had broken through. Two bishops, it was announced, had in fact been consecrated in Ankara against the will and rights of the Holy See. Then 3 months later, it was stated that 8 more had received episcopal consecration, again without the Holy See's permission. And now it appears there are 13 excommunicated bishops in China who may be the nucleus of a schismatic.